At Cocoa, we believe that we pitch to founders. And so our kind of presentation card is we build a pitch deck about, like, we are Cocoa, this is what we're about, for founders. And that's also on the in-house VC. It's like, you know, we want to be this safe place for founders, super neutral, non-threatening, totally equal to equal.
Sounds amazing. Sounds like a place to be, Carmen, for founders.
Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
This episode of EU Startups Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. Are you building a business? Achieving compliance with frameworks like ISO 27001 and SOC 2 can help you win bigger deals, enter new markets, and deepen trust with customers. But this can also cost you real time and money. Vanta rhymes with Santa. Automates up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand frameworks, helping businesses get compliant quickly. And with over 300 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your businesses rely on. Join over 7,000 fast-growing companies that use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. To learn more about how Vanta works and to get 20% off, visit vanta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups. Now, kick back and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups Podcast. Today my guest is the one and only Carmen Alfonso Rico. Carmen is a VC turned angel at Cocoa, an angel fund backed by tech founders. Cocoa invests angel checks into European pre-seed and seed companies and supports founders in their in-house VC. She's also one of the nicest human beings that I've ever met in my life. Everyone, please give it up for Carmen Alfonso Rico. Awesome to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, while a kind intro bar is now high. very excited to be with you again. It's always super fun to hang out. And yeah, super excited to tell you more about whatever you want. You know me by now. I have no filter, so I'm all yours.
Amazing. So Carmen, so okay, that sounds great. Let's do it. No filters then. I know that you were born in Spain, but quite early you swapped tapas for Curryverse. So can you tell me how did it impact your life, and maybe like does it have an impact on your approach to business as well?
100%. Yes, I'm a bit of a hybrid, like bipolar hybrid. I am from Spain, like my name gives it away, my accent. I actually absolutely love being from Spain. But as you mentioned, when I was very little, I was like 11, I was sent to boarding school in Germany. And yeah. This comes from my parents' obsessions with languages. And I did change tapas and jamón for like sauerkraut and bread. It shaped me a lot. I think, first of all, because it was really hard. Like, I was very little. I was, you know, very close to my family. And Germany was a complete different country and different culture. And being by myself at boarding school initially was really hard. I think now, looking back, it's one of the most impactful things in my own character. At the end of the day, you become very resourceful because you have to, right? Like you, this feeling seems like, but like of being sick and yes, having of course doctors at school and stuff, but being alone or like being at an airport alone when there's a delay and you need to manage that, like all this little by little, it builds a lot of resilience and a lot of resourcefulness. And it just makes you like, basically the world becomes kind of your oyster because, you know, there's nothing you can't do. And that's something my parents did a great job with. It's like, I was born thinking everything, I know the brain, everything and anything was possible, right? And so that shaped me. Then other, if you actually think about it, it's very different culture and very different way to like think about the world, to work. And I think that I benefited from that dualism. Like I'm very much like creative improvisation. Like I operate very well in like chaos as the good Spaniard that I am. And I'm very like passion driven and like very, you know, but at the same time, I'm very structured. Like, I like love processes, scalability, you know, like if you think about Cocoa, Cocoa runs like an execution machine. Like, and it has to, otherwise it wouldn't work. But it's so funny because many times I meet people and like, you know, they see the Spanish in me and then we talk. And then many times I'm like, yeah, because I was in Germany, and they're like, ah. That explains a lot. So I think that then actually from Germany, I went to the US and I was there at boarding school, spent quite some time there. And I guess there also, I got a lot of the pragmatism, like problem solving approach, business mindset. So I'm actually really lucky that despite the fact that I used to cry so much and I would call my parents and tell them they didn't love me, that's why they had sent me to boarding school. I am forever grateful that they stood by it, that they didn't come pick me up, that I know themselves, my mom cried. Like when you tell your mom you're 11, you don't love me. But like, it's the best thing they've done for me because they've built such like multidimensional kind of capabilities and like such a big view of the world and quite a bit of resourcefulness, especially at airports, that I'm forever grateful.
Awesome. Karen, this sounds amazing. Also, before we move to the next questions, can I ask you to move a bit more towards your left?
Sorry, yes. This is very homemade. So we're in Cocoa's HQ, as everybody can see. And hack the setup.
Awesome. So I know already by now very well that you know, you're super passionate about chocolate. Your passion for chocolate is very evident, what can I say? So two things here. Could you share the sweet story behind Cocoa? And maybe then you could break down the chocolate making process for us, Carmen, and tell us, you know, how it relates to your approach to investing or startup journey.
100%, and you're challenging me on the technicalities of chocolate.
Oh, yeah.
I'll try to stand up to it. So basically, it's actually all related because where the name comes from is that I was looking for like a cool name, but cool, not too cool for school, that was approachable, friendly, playful, but that people could just like relate to and that you could create sort of a sense of belonging to, right? And totally unrelated to this thought process, reality is that I've always loved chocolate. Ever since I was little, it's the only sweet I like. I was a really weird kid. I don't like ice cream. I don't like cake. I don't like Haribo or candy. Only chocolate. Mm-hmm. Like, it was only chocolate. And so one day I was in Barcelona during one of the COVID lockdowns, and literally the name, like I was swimming. I love to swim, just like you can do sports and let your mind wander. And literally this name came to me. It was like Cocoa. And I stormed out and told my husband, and I was like, Cocoa. And he loved it. And then actually, what we did was with Anthony, who also like started Cocoa with me, like we went to a chocolate store in Barcelona because we wanted, this is a funny thing, one very good friend of ours is Sia from Seed Camp, and he's Swiss. So his bar on chocolate is really high.
Yeah.
And so we got a Spaniard like trying to like present a chocolate name to a Swiss person. And so we went to buy him some chocolate. And this is the key part. We went to buy him some chocolate to present the name. And we were at this very fancy chocolate store in Barcelona called Cacao Sampaca. And at the counter, while we were paying, they have the faces of making chocolate.
Yeah.
And so I was standing there looking at it and I was like, wait, this is like, you know, like it goes to our cocoa beans, it ends at the chocolate bar. I was like, this is like pre-seed, seed, series A, series B, series A, IPO. I was like, it's the face of making chocolate. Cocoa is the seed of chocolate. And you've got many stages from the seed of chocolate to the chocolate bar, like you do in starting a startup. And things that people don't know, because then we went on a rabbit hole on chocolate research, but is that actually making chocolate is a very hard process. It requires a lot of input. A lot of expertise, a lot of passion. It's like, and so it just really reminded me to like, you know, the art of building a startup. And that's it. Cocoa is a seed of chocolate. And to your point on how do you make chocolate? So basically the idea is like you have the harvesting part, right? And then you take like the big cocoa pods, which by the way are a fruit. If anybody does, we shouldn't, you know. And you open them, and there's this thing called baba, which is in Spanish, like also baba is like the saliva, but basically it's like this fruit that is very bitter. And like, actually that's how they figure out chocolate, because people use that to get drunk. There's this expert in chocolate making called Spencer, who was the founder of Last FM, and now is the founder of a company called Cocoa Runners that curates chocolate around the world, that has this quote that says that most discoveries in the world were because people wanted to drink, like bread as well, and chocolate the same. And so basically you take that out, and then you kind of ferment it, and then dry and roast it. And that's where the like cacao or cocoa beans come out. And then you have to do like the cracking and the winnowing and the tempering, which is really difficult. And then the chocolate bar eventually. That's why, because this whole process, this is why chocolate actually has gone through a big evolution. Like initially cocoa beans were a currency. Then actually the Aztecas and the Mayas in Mexico would just drink it as the drink of the gods. Like there was no bar. There was not even, it was not even sweet. Then it came to Europe. Then in Europe, like they did several things up until Nestlé invented the bar. Like, you know, there's like this whole process and traveling around the world and different kind of chemical developments up until the bar. But even today, it's quite a labor intensive, like work of love to produce chocolate. And that's very much like what we also want to do.
Amazing. Carmen loved it. And yes, you passed the test. Bravo, everyone. Give it up for Carmen. Another question that I have for you is... Oh, actually, let's do that. I would love to play a game with you now, if you're up for it.
Always up for it.
Awesome. So, you know, while preparing for this podcast, I did a research on you again, and I went through the Cocoa speech for founders. And I found there some cool terms that you've coined. And so how about I tell you the term and you're going to elaborate on that term for us a bit?
Would love that. Absolutely love it.
Awesome. So tell us about Killers with a Heart.
Oh, Killers with a Heart is a very big one. It's basically how we think of the founders that we want to back. And this term, which was actually coined originally because I wanted to introduce a few founders that I knew to other people. And when I made the intro, I said they're killers with a heart. And then it actually kind of stuck. And it's a very Cocoa's term. What is a killer with a heart to us? A killer with a heart is a founder who is completely obsessed. Like, the point is, if you're going to start a startup, or launch a startup, you're gonna build a company, you need to have an almost irrational reason to wanna solve the problem that you're going after. Because it is gonna get so hard that unless you're powered by an irrational force, it just makes no rational sense, basically, right? So that resilience that founders need comes from that. It's like an obsession. And this particular case, and why I'm so focused on people who have a very strong reason to do what they're going to do and obsess about it, is because I launched a company a few years ago and I didn't care about the problem. It was a fashion company. I was optimizing for being a founder and I got bored. Because I didn't care about the program. Whereas now I think about Cocoa and investing in founders, which is my favorite thing in the world. And that powers me. So that's one, obsess. The second one is you have an ambition that is borderline naive, but not delusional. And the line is quite thin here. But basically, look at it is through speed of execution, speed of learning. Because the point here is, we don't need founders to know all the challenges that lie ahead of them. Again, because if they would know, they might actually not do it. Yeah. So there's the naive part there. But we want founders to be able to overcome those challenges when they come, because they are going to come for sure. And so that's this ambition, borderline naive, but that's not delusional. And the third one is clarity of mind and clarity of vision. And I think that the point here is that you need founders who have a very, very deep understanding of the problem they're solving, the market they're gonna be going after, like unique insights. Now, how do you measure this? because it's really hard. And some of them, we're generalists. So we go from talking about molecular glue to talking about transport and logistics. So like what we know is very little about everything. And so how do you measure whether somebody really understands what they're building? Through the clarity of mind that they can explain it with. Because if you can explain to me how AI can play a role in solving the problems in steelmaking without me knowing anything about steelmaking, you understand it to a level that is basically like, you know, the palm of your hand. And that's what we also look for. So you've got kind of these very big three things: obsession, ambition, borderline naive, clarity of mind, clarity of vision.
Amazing. I love it. How about building cult-like businesses and having this insane customer love? Maybe you can elaborate on that.
Absolutely. So I have a thing for companies that basically create like a community around them. Like it's basically, and this is the Spanish and the German part of me, you're going to see it playing out. So basically, when you have a product, when you have an experience that people love so much, that they interact through it, that they build communities, that they help each other, like to, like, you know, be able to use the product, that they basically want to be associated with. When you can build that sense of belonging, when you can make people part of it, that is an emotional connection between your product, your community, your crowd, and like the company. Now, that emotional connection, which is like a behavior I can understand in the Spanish side of my brain, brings incredible defensibility and scalability. And this is the German part of me. Basically, at the end of the day, if you have these kind of ambassadors, you can grow organically, which is one of the biggest challenges in scaling, and you can defend your business, right? And I'll give you two examples. There's a company called SideQuest, which I angel invested in years ago. SideQuest is the biggest community in VR. And so basically they have millions of monthly active users. Basically everybody who owns an Oculus or a headset is on SideQuest. And every developer of VR is there. Now people love it so much. If you look at their Twitter, their Discord, like they feel part of it. They feel SideQuest is partly theirs. Now, if you think about now a competitor, it's like, what do you need to do? What do you need to build? What set of incentives do you need to give people to move from SideQuest to another platform? Like, why would they? Like, they've got all the content. They've got everybody who's there, like, is there. Like, it builds big defensibility. And then another example is a company, Totally, because this can happen in B2C and in B2B, right? Total B2B data infra. So imagine, like, as unsexy, basically, as you can go, called eventstore.com. Eventstore.com is an open source project database for events, and not events, the ones you and I go, but events as a unit of data, which is a unit of data with context. Okay, very technical. Most of their team is made up of people who in other jobs came across Eventstore to use it for their own, like whatever they were building, and were so blown away that they thought they needed to be part of expanding this to the rest of the world. And they joined Eventstore. So from a talent perspective, from a customer perspective, scalability, defensibility, the power of a cult is incredible. And so I just like to look for these behaviors.
Amazing. Love it again. Carmen, last one. What is in-house VC?
That's another term. I'm originally a lawyer, so the in-house lawyer term was very common to me. And then I thought, well, why wouldn't you have an in-house VC? Basically, this is the very core of Cocoa's value proposition to founders, and also the very core of Cocoa's origin on itself. Yes. Cocoa is born years after the story I'm going to tell you, but this is what kicks it all off. I was a partner in a seed fund. And a business angel asked me as a favor, a business angel called Andrew Bites, I always give him the credit, asked me as a favor to meet a founder and tell him what I thought. So pure DD exercise, I couldn't invest from the fund because it was pre-launch and this fund didn't invest in pre-launch, but I went there to meet this founder. This founder was Johnny from Hopin. Back then he was raising 250K pre-seed. This is summer 2019.
Yeah.
He was struggling to raise. And I met him. I was hooked by him. I loved the product. I really wanted to help him. Now, I couldn't invest directly from my fund and lead the round, but I helped him not doing what I knew how to do, which was basically, now looking back, being a VC. But being a VC from the position of an angel investor. And so I introduced him to every investor he met. Everybody from the lead of the round to my family, everybody I introduced him to. I did the same for the seed. I review his term sheet. I help him with a lawyer. I build the actual Excel spreadsheet of the cap table. Like, all these things that were my day job, was what I was doing in my day job. But suddenly I was doing it now from another position, from the founder's position, because I was a small angel. Then what I realized was I was building a very unique relationship of trust with him. And I figured in my mind it had to do with the fact that on one side I was tiny in his cap table. Like, literally insignificant, basically. But on the other hand, I knew how a VC thought. I knew how a VC worked. I knew who the VCs were because I was one of them. And so back then, I didn't add 2 + 2 on, like, oh my God, this could be a thing. But I absolutely loved it. So I started to do lots of angel investments, side questing through that, like many others. And so I started to see a pattern that actually founders, when they were raising rounds and after the round, they had 2 distinct groups. They had the VCs, which owned big chunk of their company, and that they added a lot of value, but, like, you know, they were a big shareholder. And then they had small angels, mostly operators. But there was nobody that, from a small, non-scary, non-threatening position, could help them navigate all the VC world. And so that's Cocoa. That's the world. Is like, we invest 250 to 500K checks, depending on the size of the round. Whole point, no friction allocation, and we don't compete with other funds, we collaborate. So we come in as small in the cap table, so that we can be neutral, independent, agnostic, like an angel. But to that angel check, angel ownership stake, bring VC expertise, VC network, become the in-house VC. So that's kind of the in-house. Awesome. And just to add on this, because you mentioned the Cocoa's founder pitch deck.
Yeah.
That is also very, very linked with the philosophy of the in-house VC, right? At Cocoa, we believe that we pitch to founders. And so our kind of presentation card is, we build a pitch deck about, like, we are Cocoa, this is what we're about for founders. And that's also on the in-house VC. It's like, you know, we want to be this safe place for founders, super neutral, non-threatening, totally equal to equal.
Sounds amazing. Sounds like a place to be, Carmen, for founders. Here's one cool question. Imagine you're throwing a Cocoa chocolate party. If you could invite anyone to that party to join you, could they be, why, and what would be the song playing in the background that, you know, kind of captures the essence of the gathering?
I must tell you, you always make the best, like, crazy questions. Funny enough, I don't have to imagine much, to be honest. On the invite guest list, anybody who knows me knows that I'm the more the merrier. And our problem at parties, which we host a lot, is actually whether we are going to go over capacity. We always sail very close to the line. That's a very Spanish part of me. But actually, I don't need to imagine much. I'm going to tell you a real story. We always throw a massive party every year. And this year, the theme was Wonka, because the movie was being released. And so we threw a party that for Willy Wonka, and actually I'll see if I can show you something about it. But to your answering your specific question, actually, I would invite Wonka, and I'm going to tell you why, and I'm going to tell you why we made it the theme. Wonka is an odd kind of eccentric character.
Right.
He basically represents, if you actually think about it, if you read the book, if you watch the earlier movies, Wonka represents everybody who can think out of the box. He basically invites all of us to accept the little, like, more odd parts of ourselves and to just imagine that anything is possible. There's this scene in the movie where the kids are, like, you know, touring the factory, and one of the kids says, yeah, but, like, I've never seen a wobble stopper, like, they don't exist. And Wonka's response is, we are the dreamers of dreams and we're the music makers. And the reason is, what he's saying there is, look, the fact that there's something that we haven't seen, the fact that there's something that doesn't exist, doesn't mean cannot imagine it, and it doesn't mean we cannot bring it, like build it. And so ultimately, we believe Wonka was like a killer with a heart, because that's the spirit that we want our founders to have, is like, the fact that something doesn't exist doesn't mean we cannot imagine it. It doesn't mean we cannot build it. And so he just invites us all to imagine and dream very, very big and build amazing things for the world, and that hopefully bring lots of joy.
Love it, Carmen. Again, amazing answer. I love it. I think it's now time for the Cocoa Startup School.
love it.
So Cocoa Startup School is a new concept that I just came up with for the needs of this interview. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you a few questions on fundraising, and you will share some practical, actionable insights with founders, if that sounds good.
Super.
Awesome. So let's start with the first one. How founders can approach investors effectively, and what key elements should they focus on to make a memorable pitch?
Okay. And I'm going to say a couple of disclaimers to frame the whole thing. Very rarely, as an in-house VC, as in never actually, do I have the right answer. I always share frameworks on how to think about things. I have a big respect for the fact that a cap table is like a founder's cap table, because it's a founder's company. So my answers just kind of try to help give frameworks and to describe how the actual VC world works, because we might agree or might disagree with the dynamics, but at the end of the day, as a founder, the best thing you can do is try to hack it. And in order to hack it, you need to know how it works. So to your point on this, the best way to get an intro is a warm intro. A few reasons for this, on how the system works. First of all, think about a VC receives like, and this is no exaggeration, a VC might meet between 10 to 20 companies a week, depending on how active they are in meetings. But it might receive like 50 plus that he or she gets sent, right? So it's a question of like spam of attention and ability to like cut through the noise, and how do you prioritize? What signals do you use to prioritize? And who enters you is a big signal on how to prioritize, because at the end of the day, we need to prioritize somehow, and that's a very useful one. So when you manage to get somebody that a VC trusts to send this VC like your company, that like skips quite a few steps. The second part also is what it says about you. So because it shows hustle, it shows that you're resourceful. It's true that not everybody has the network and not everybody can get these intros. But if you kind of look for smart ways to try and get to a VC, that first of all might get you further. And also it is like, it shows hustle to the VC, which is a key feature of a founder. So I think those two. And things to not do, the thing is, blast emails with the wrong name. Blast emails with like, you know, that, it happens all the time. Like, and I understand that this is a funnel, like fundraising is a B2B sales funnel and you need to fit the top of the funnel. 100% agree with that. But you need to qualify it. And this is what goes to the other thing is, look, if a venture fund has on their first page of their website that they only invest in Europe and you're based in Pakistan, you can't send, like, it's just, it reflects really badly on it, right? And so I think that the idea is, look, do the work to qualify. And I know it's really hard because it's not a transparent industry, but at least do the work. It shows if you've done the work, even if like you land on the wrong conclusion like that, the work. And then know that you need to cut through the noise. And so with the intro, with the content of your pitch, it has to be clear what you like. First of all, like, cut through the noise to the intro, so the investor will read the deck, and then once they read the deck, mega clear concise key messages so that the investor wants to speak to you. That's the next goal, is to get him or her in front of you. And for that, they need to understand what you do, and they need to understand it very quickly, because the amount of minutes and attention that is going to be devoted to that, given everything else, is limited. And so if you have a 50 page deck, and by page 20, slide 20, they still don't know what they do, they're not going to convert. It doesn't happen. They're going to drop. And so a teaser, the deck, when sent like before you meet in person, should be a teaser. So I read it, maybe sometimes while I'm doing something else, but I read it, but I know who you are, what you're doing. Why is it you that you're an interesting team? Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Thanks for that, Carmen. Next one. When thinking about the funding round, what frameworks or mental models can founders use to navigate the process successfully and, you know, make strategic decisions that align with their long-term vision?
Very good question also, because it becomes a lot of, there's so many drivers that actually are kind of interrelated, and there's the rational and the emotional part, because actually, at the end, choosing an investor is also a very emotional decision. So I came up with this kind of framework, which is not rocket science, but it hopefully simplifies a lot, which I call the round equation. And the round equation is as simple as this. On one side of the equation, you've got what you get from the financing, which is money plus value add. And the value add is comprised of a lots of things, depending also on what you're optimizing for, but it comprises everything from like the network of the VC when it comes to hiring, the network of the VC when it comes to customers, the actual like a brand of the VC for like attracting capital in the next round, the personal fit. This is absolutely key. So all that kind of value that you get from a VC, money plus value add, needs to exceed what you pay. And what is it that you're paying for that money and value that you're getting? The most quantifiable way to look at it is dilution. So the percentage of the company, of your company that you're giving away, one. But you're also, and not to be forgotten, giving away economic and political rights. Ideally, and thankfully in this market, they're pretty standard. So like it's, but still, you're giving away economic and political rights. And you're adding complexity. And so many times, I'll give an example. Many times founders are like, oh, should I have three large investors? I'm like, there's no yes or no answer to this. There is the following, is three large investors add complexity. So the money plus value add that you get needs to make up for that increased complexity. So it's an opportunity cost analysis, and those are the factors.
Amazing. That's going to be a last one now, Carmen. So, as part of Kokoa's guidance for founders, what are some crucial do's and don'ts you'd advise when they're in the process of securing funding? So, and any pitfalls to avoid or essential actions to take?
Absolutely. Okay, so this metaphor has been used a million times, but it's actually really useful. Fundraising is a B2B sales funnel process, but it's also like dating, right? Like, think about it a lot like dating. And so you need to build momentum, and you need to make people want you, but also like learn whether you want these people at the same time. Like basically at the end is apply hustle and apply common sense and think of it as dating. So you would respond to a message of a girl or a guy that you like and build some momentum, but you won't stalk this girl or this guy, or you wouldn't go too far.
Hopefully
don't stalk. But the point is, what is that balance that allows you to build momentum and keep the momentum going? I think that that's key. And also like, but be truthful, build relationships of transparency. This is a key one. VCs talk all the time. So playing VCs is generally like not a great idea unless you're playing them with actual facts. So if I tell you I have a term sheet from Fund X, you are going to check whether that's the case. Yeah. And if that is not the case, then trust is broken. 100%. So play, but don't overplay. Always be honest, always be truthful, because you are getting into relationships that will last for years. And so it only works if it's based on honesty and truthfulness. So that's one. And the other one, which is a useful framework, is when you think about the value add and what you're getting, also think about the following. This company, I always say this about Kokoa. Kokoa is both the joy of my life and the hardest thing I've done. And the fact that it is the joy of my life doesn't mean it's less hard. The fact that it's hard doesn't mean it's less joyful.
Yeah.
But you need to think of building around that you can see going to work with these people that are going to join your company is going to be joyful. Mm-hmm. Because if not, and this is where the personal fit comes in, if not, you won't be, like, it just be unbearable. And so obviously optimize for a brand of the fund, obviously optimize for the terms, 100%. This is all the rational, but do not forget the personal fit. And do I like this person? Do I want to hang out with this person? Do I want to call them when things go wrong? Do I want to call them when to celebrate when things go right? So I think that that is important. And then last but not least, we're going from more emotional to more quantifiable, because it's something that we're seeing in the market a lot. Another useful framework is what I call the Holy Trinity. And this is the, when you think
the
about
Holy the Trinity,
and it's an unholy Trinity, but yes, when you when you think about the actual terms, like, of the round, like, how much should you raise, at what dilution, at what valuation, think about it like this: the key driver of a round should be the money the business needs. Okay, so how much money do you need to get to the next round? Raise, mm-hmm. or if you're really lucky, to be profitable and never raise again. But generally, if you follow it to the next round, think about, if you're a seed company, let's take to get today's market conditions, Series A's are anywhere between, you are required to have 2 to 4 million ARR, let's say 2 to 3 million ARR, okay? Yeah. And you're standing today on 500K ARR, you look at how much money, i.e. how many resources, do I think I'm gonna need to get to 2 million ARR? So I'm in a good place to raise a Series A. And then add a buffer, because, you know, things always take longer, things are...
Yeah.
Another dimension is the time. Make sure that you have 18 minimum to up to 30 months of runway. Why? Because if you have 18 months of runway, you have 12 to build, 6 to raise. So actually in 12 months, there's not much time to build, like, or to achieve, like, big milestones. So make sure that you buy the time. So you take the goals, quantifiable goals, and you take the time and you say, okay, so this leads me to believe I need 3 million making this up. Okay, great. Then the next phase is, at what price? So how much of the company should I give away? And then what you need to think about is minimize it, obviously, like, try to get us. But be mindful that funds, if you are doing an institutional round, funds have a minimum ownership stake. And they do so because otherwise their unit economics don't work. And I won't get into this because I feel really passionate about this, but they have a minimum stake, which goes anywhere between 10 to 15. Uh-huh. Right? Generally 10 to 12, perfect, percent. So that. Now, also, you take the amount of the money the business needs, and let's say 20% dilution, which is like the standard across the board, across ages and stages. Mm-hmm. And then you take, okay, 3 million. If it's 20% dilution, that's a 15 million post. Okay? And then you look at that 15 million post and you think, am I confident that I can raise the next round at 2 to 3x this valuation? Because the mistake sometimes founders made is that they over-optimize for this top-line valuation. My tip to you founders is, don't over-optimize for the top-line, because the top-line actually is a product of many factors. So I can raise 3 million at 30 million post, and I've given away 10% of the business. Super great price. I can raise 10 million at 30 million post, and I've given away 30% of the business, and it's the same top line valuation, but totally different price. So think about the price you pay as the percentage of the company you give away, i.e. dilution, and use the top line to think that you, with the money that you're raising, and your business and the market and many other things, do you feel confident you can raise 2 to 3x? At 2 to 3x that valuation, i.e. can you grow it to that valuation? Because what's happening a lot is founders are over-optimizing for valuation in the short term. We've seen it in... And then the business doesn't get to where it needs to get to have a higher valuation. And then it becomes really painful to raise a flat round or even a down round, right? And so at the end of the day, in this size of the money that the business needs, determines the size of the round, minimize your dilution, but be mindful of the pressure that the top line valuation is putting on you.
Yeah.
Overlay it with, the more owner of your own destiny you are, the better.
amazing. So that was a masterclass on fundraising by Carmen Alfonso Rico. Everyone, that was actually also a last question. Everyone, clap for Carmen. That's a wrap.
Okay, thank you so very much. It's my privilege to be here. So much fun.
Amazing. Carmen, lovely to have you on the show again. And so maybe to finish it off, do you have, like, what's new? Do you have any cool projects or initiatives going on? What would you like to share, like, as a last thing with the audience?
So I'm actually very excited about 2024. I think 2023 for all of us in tech felt a little bit like walking through the mud in the middle of the desert. There was a lot of work, there was a lot of grinding, and it felt like pretty, like we were progressing, but pretty flat, not upwards. And I think we're a sector used to feeling kind of we're going upwards. So I'm quite excited about 2024 feeling like much more upwards. And in terms of Cocoa, I'm very excited because our portfolio is like healthy and strong, and we will have they will achieve big milestones in 2024. I'm excited because we will eventually, not yet, but eventually raise Cocoa too, and so also go on our next kind of milestone ourselves. And then I'm excited also because we've spent the summer, past summer, and quite a bit of Christmas doing a lot of work around optimizing the ops of the company. At the end of the day, we're investors, but we're also the founders of a small company that is Cocoa. And we've rebuilt our own CRM, drive and task management ourselves on Notion. And now we have this Notion machine that we're in love with. And like we've optimized this. So it starts to be also Cocoa now is 2.5 years old. And so we start to also be like, there's been a little bit of emotion. We're a proper company and that's very exciting.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Carmen. Lovely having you on the show, as I said. And I wish you all the best and stay strong and healthy as your portfolio. And I hope to talk to you very soon and see you in person soon as well.
See you very soon. Bye, everybody.
Ciao.